Loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker. Aleppo has been liberated by the Syrian army, prompting scenes of jubilation in the streets as thousands return home. But the mainstream media in the United States is painting a very different picture of what's taking place. The CIA, President Obama, and now the leaders of the Republican and Democratic Party in Congress continue to push the story that Russia interfered in the U.S. elections in 2016. We'll speak with NSA whistleblower William Binney about the argument that these email revelations were inside leaks, not outside hacks. U.S. Secretary of Defense Ash Carter was in Israel on Monday to deliver the first two F-35 fighter jets, each costing $100 million, maybe $200 million. But the Lockheed Martin company stock fell, almost lost $2 billion in value when Donald Trump took to Twitter to say the costs of the program were out of control. But first, we turn to the liberation of Aleppo and the war in Syria. We are joined from London by Alexander Makuris, the editor-in-chief of the Duran. Welcome back, Alexander.
Good to be here.
Yeah, thank you for joining. Scenes of celebration were to be seen on television coverage on the ground in Aleppo on Monday night as the Syrian army was close to declaring the full liberation of the city. Tell us about how historic this victory is for Syria and for its impact long-term on the war.
It is vitally important for Syria. This has been, first of all, by far the greatest battle of the war. The largest number of troops and fighters on either side have been involved in it. And, of course, Aleppo is or was Syria's biggest city, its main industrial center. There have been times when it has contested with Damascus the possibility of being Syria's capital, and it is one of the oldest and most historic cities of the Arab world, and of course of Syria itself. So for Syria to have lost Aleppo would have been a devastating blow and would have compromised the entire existence of the Syrian state. For Syria to retain Aleppo means that the Syrian state now has a very strong probability, bordering almost on a certainty, of being preserved. So this is a huge victory for the Syrians and is one that will have huge repercussions for the future development of this conflict.
Alexander Makuris, the way the U.S. media, the mainstream media, is treating this battle and this battle right now compared, say, to the Russian media, of course, to the Syrian media, to a lot of other media, is so profoundly, diametrically different. I'm going to read to you the headline from the New York Times on December 13th, quote, "A complete meltdown of humanity," close quote. They're quoting the UN or a UN Human Rights Commission, so-called. "Civilians die in fight for eastern Aleppo." And then the article says, "Pro-government forces retaking the eastern neighborhood of the besieged Syrian city of Aleppo killed at least 82 civilians on Monday, the United Nations estimated, in what one official called a complete meltdown of humanity." That's the lead paragraph about the news that the terrorist forces are being driven out of East Aleppo.
One is looking at this battle from such different perspectives that it's almost as if two completely different battles were being written about. Now, on these allegations of atrocities against civilians by the Syrian army and by the various militias that are allied to it, the United Nations Secretary General, Mr. Ban Ki-moon, previously said that those reports were unverified. These unverified reports are now being reported as if they were actual fact. And I'm afraid when that happens, one has to question the truth and validity of these reports. It is not surprising that the media in the United States and in certain other Western countries is reporting the battle in Aleppo and the victory of the Syrian army in this way. Because the United States and its allies have been committed to pursuing a regime change agenda in Syria. Their defeat in Aleppo, the defeat of the rebels in Aleppo, means that that regime change agenda has, at least for the moment, been defeated. And I'm afraid that we're seeing articles like this, which express the frustration and anger of those in Washington and elsewhere who are angry with the failure of this agenda.
Alexander, if it was just the Washington officials, the Obama administration and the Defense Department, which, as you said, they've been clear since 2011, their main goal was to overthrow the Assad government. If they were saying it, okay, people would say, well, that's one side of the war, even though that side has had a sort of schizophrenic policy, I would say, about Syria. But the New York Times article goes on in the second paragraph to quote Zayed Raad al-Hussein, the United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights, who warned that the bloodbath in Aleppo, once thriving northern metropolis that is close to falling, is a precursor to what might be happening in Douma, in Raqqa, and in Idlib. We cannot let this continue, according to Zayed Raad al-Hussein from the United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights. So it sounds like it's not Washington. It's got the prestige, the credibility of the international body, the Human Rights Commissioner for the United Nations. Talk about that organization, not just the UN, but about this organization, the Commission for Human Rights.
Well, in fact, one of the most depressing facts about this whole conflict is the way in which the United Nations Human Rights Commission and indeed various other elements of the United Nations Secretariat have over the last couple of years aligned themselves very closely with this United States regime change policy, which is, of course, also a policy that has been supported consistently, not just by the Western powers, but by certain other very influential Arab and Middle Eastern countries, specifically Saudi Arabia and its friends. And I'm afraid that influence has managed to tilt the impartiality of these bodies, which is extremely important in order to make the international system function properly, and has made them side with a particular group of states as they have pursued this regime change agenda in the Middle East. And I'm afraid what you just heard is an expression of that, because I don't personally place much credence on this, for the simple reason, as I said before, that the Secretary General himself of the United Nations, Mr. Ban Ki-moon, was previously saying these reports are unverified. So we're basically looking at a propaganda campaign, and it is very sad to see these UN agencies supporting it.
Right. He himself is a Jordanian prince. He's part of the Jordanian monarchy. He was also part of the International Criminal Court that was also targeting the leadership in former Yugoslavia after the United States helped with NATO to bomb and destroy Yugoslavia. So it's part of a long continuum where the United States, when it's convenient, uses the United Nations sort of as a fig leaf or as an extension of American power, but then gives it the seeming legitimacy of being an international body. But when he talks about, well, this could be the fate of the people in Raqqa, and I'm thinking to myself, Alexander, wow, well, Raqqa is the capital of the caliphate. It's the capital of Daesh, of ISIS. The suggestion is that Raqqa, too, should not be liberated. And this after the United States government has identified ISIS as an existential threat, something that must be degraded and defeated. But they're preparing the public for any military action, even against Raqqa, would be just a promotion of human rights violations.
Well, indeed, sir. And of course, Idlib is also controlled by organizations that are connected with al-Qaeda, who are the people who carried out terrorist attacks against the United States in 2001 and 9/11. So we have this extraordinary combination of states and organizations. And of course, let us be very clear, Jordan has been a major player in the international coalition to achieve regime change in Syria. It has hosted a lot of the rebel groups that have been waging this war against Syria and which are now being defeated. But it seems that for them, the agenda of overthrowing the government in Syria trumps any desire to destroy the ISIS caliphate, to defeat al-Qaeda, to do any of these other things. And it is better, it seems, to condemn the people who live in these places, in Raqqa and Idlib, to rule by ISIS, with all the very murderous practices that ISIS is known to follow, or Idlib, which is ruled by al-Qaeda, than it is to liberate them from the from those groups. So it is very depressing, and unfortunately, it is also predictable.
I'm glad we're actually talking about Jordan and the role of Jordan, because most Americans don't know that since 2011, when Hillary Clinton and President Obama took up the mantra following the destruction of the Libyan government, again by NATO bombing, again with a noble cause as its intended purpose to save civilians, the mantra was Assad must go, Assad must go. But the United States government under Obama was hesitant to have direct major sort of upfront leadership in the military campaign against Assad as they had in the Libya campaign. And so they use proxies. They use Turkey. They use Saudi Arabia. They use Qatar. But Jordan was the place where and I think this is the thing Americans don't know, that Jordan was the place, Amman was the place where the United States CIA coordinated a lot of those weapon shipments and funneling of funds and the transport of fighters into the battle in Syria, again, from the battlefields in Libya and elsewhere. Jordan was right there. They could not have done what they did to Syria, meaning the regional proxies and the Western powers, namely the United States, without Jordan as a logistics coordinating center. And yet nobody's really paying attention to Jordan's role in the destruction of Syria and the terrible oceans of human suffering that have been imposed on the Syrian people. And now we have the prince, the so-called commissioner in charge of human rights at the UN, this Jordanian prince, saying, we cannot allow this to go forward. This is a crime against humanity. I mean, it's dripping with hypocrisy.
It is dripping with hypocrisy, as you say. And if we come to Jordan, Jordan is, actually, as you also rightly say, a country that generally seems to avoid, manages to get below people's radar when it comes to the Middle East, even though it is an absolutely key U.S. ally and has been in the Middle East for decades, going all the way back to the 1960s. And, of course, in Syria, in the Syrian conflict, it has been absolutely crucial to making the Syrian conflict possible. All of these Arab monarchies, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, the Gulf monarchies, have all been heavily implicated in this affair. And as you also correctly say, they have willingly used themselves as proxies of the United States and its regime change agenda. And indeed, they have pursued that agenda at times even more vigorously than the United States has done. I would add one further thing, which is that I think all of these comments that we are seeing from Jordan, from other Arab countries, indeed from some Western countries, and from the US media, are partly intended by what I would call the regime change coalition to try to box in the incoming US administration of Mr. Trump, which has at times sort of suggested that it might have a rather different agenda in the Middle East. Whether it will remains to be seen.
Alexander Mercuris, the Syrian government made it clear over the past months that they would offer an amnesty plan, at least for the Syrian fighters who were part of the jihadi movement, part of the terrorist organizations, not necessarily for the foreign fighters, but for Syrians. At the same time, the United Nations and other international entities have tried to allow for the Battle of East Aleppo to end by creating corridors where not only civilians, but sometimes fighters, the rebels, could leave and relocate elsewhere. What do you think? Are the rebels who are still holding out in East Aleppo, is this a fight to the finish for them? Or are they still hoping to be able to evacuate, to go to Idlib or go somewhere else to live for another day or to fight for another day?
I think if you look at the record over the last a couple of months, you will see that the Syrians and the Russians have actually held out that kind of offer to the fighters in Aleppo for a long time. They basically said, we want you all to leave eastern Aleppo, take whatever civilians who want to join you with you. we're prepared to set up these humanitarian corridors, but you must go. What it seems that up till now, they have consistently refused to go. They have always said that they will fight to the finish. Now that we have almost reached the finish, and it is clear that they are going to be defeated, there are rumors, and we don't yet know how confirmed those rumors are, that some of them at least are now thinking of accepting that offer. Whether that offer, in these very different circumstances, is still there is something which just remains to be seen. We simply don't know yet. There are arguments for the Russians and the Syrians to do it, and then there are other arguments the other way. We will just have to wait and see.
We're talking with Alexander Mercuris, the editor of the Duran in London. 1 minute left, Alexander. While Aleppo is being liberated, ISIS has carried out the attack on Palmyra. Perhaps sobering for those who thought the war might be wrapping up. Palmyra was taken by Daesh in May of 2015 and retaken by the Syrian army in March of this year. Talk about the importance of Palmyra. Is it a symbolic, is it psychological, or is it key to the military outcome?
I think it is primarily symbolic and psychological. It doesn't mean that it has no significance at all. There are oil fields around Palmyra which are important for providing energy to places like Damascus and its hinterland. So for the Syrian government, it has an economic importance. It is not existentially important in the way that Aleppo is. Having said that, I have no doubt at all that the Russians, who regard Palmyra as absolutely central to their prestige, will ensure that Palmyra is taken back. And the Russian Foreign Ministry has made very clear that he believes that the attack on Palmyra was intended to divert troops and forces away from Aleppo in order to take the pressure off the fighters there. So I think these two events are connected. I'm afraid it shows that the war is still continuing. I do expect Palmyra to be retaken soon.
Okay, we're going to leave it there. We've been speaking from London with Alexander Mercuris, the editor-in-chief of the Duran. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear. Loud and Clear.
You are listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. The CIA, and now President Obama, and leaders both of the Democratic Party and the Republican Party in Congress continue to push the story that Russia hacked emails from the Democratic Party and possibly the Republican Party, but more the Democratic Party, to help Donald Trump become president of the United States. And President Obama has ordered an investigation into this issue. We'll speak now with NSA whistleblower William Binney about his argument that these were inside leaks, not outside hacks from Russia or some other entity. We are joined from Maryland by NSA whistleblower Mr. Binney to talk about the statement that he wrote for the Veterans Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, or VIPS. Welcome back, Bill Binney.
Oh, thanks for having me back. Yeah.
Bill, your article that's up on Consortium News and other sites and represents really not just your thinking, but the thinking of other intelligence veterans, and the title is U.S. Intel Vets Dispute Russia Hacking Claims. It really goes over the facts, something that's been really missing in the mainstream media. And your assertion is that the facts don't add up to the allegation that this was, in fact, a Russian hack or a hack at all.
Yeah, sure. That's right. Because, I mean, in order to get to the servers, they would have to come across the network and go into the servers, penetrate them, and then extract data out of the servers and bring it back across the network. And then, if it were the Russians, then go to Russia, and then they'd have to go from there into across the network again to get to WikiLeaks. Well, the point is that anything doing that would be picked up by NSA's vast surveillance system, both in terms of collecting the data as it transits the fiber optics inside the U.S. as well as internationally. And also, they have traceroute packets all embedded in hundreds of switches around the world. which means they could trace the route of all the packets, where they came from, where they went, and how they got there. And so it's a matter of saying with all the billions that we spent on this collection access system that NSA has, why there's no way that that could have missed all the packets being transferred from those servers but to the Russians. I mean, they should know exactly how and when those packets left those servers and went to the Russians and where specifically in Russia it went. There's no excuse for not knowing that.
So this is important, the idea that the NSA, if this was a hack, that the NSA would know both the point of transit. In other words, they would know who was the sender and they would know who the recipient was of the hacking material. They would know because of the comprehensive surveillance that they're able to carry out and do carry out on the World Wide Web. That's what you're saying. And what the CIA is saying and what the Obama administration is saying is that based on circumstantial evidence, they've concluded that there was a Russian hack. In other words, there would be no need at all for circumstantial evidence if the NSA has access to this kind of information. And if the hack took place, they would know about it. They would be able to trace it.
That's correct, yeah.
Talk about how much we know about this network thanks to the work of Edward Snowden.
Yes, he basically pulled the data showing their entire effort worldwide. And primarily, I think he was focused on the United States. But, I mean, internally, the main program they're using is the Fairview program. That has about 100 taps in the fiber network inside the United States, lower 48 states of the United States. And that basically means that they have access to, and they're distributed with the population, by the way. They're not along the coasts. If they were only after foreigners, that's where they'd be. But they're really after the U.S. population and all the servers and what have you inside the United States. So, and those taps distributed with the population are the thing that they're using to access and collect content as well as metadata and all the information passing around the United States. That's why they have to keep building bigger and bigger storage facilities, you know, and like, for example, the facility they're building on Fort Meade now is a 2.8 million square foot facility. That's three times the size of Utah. Well, if you think basically, if you took General Alexander's assertion that they want to collect everything, that's an ever increasing amount year after year. That means you have to keep building bigger and bigger storage facilities to maintain it. Until they get into something like quantum storage, at that point, then the size of the storage facilities should shrink.
Bill Binney, President Obama, speaking on The Daily Show on Comedy Central a couple nights ago, said Russia is trying to influence our elections, and this dates back to the Soviet Union. What they did here, again, this is President Obama's words, hacking some emails and releasing them is not a particularly fancy brand of espionage or propaganda. We were frankly more concerned in the run-up to the election to the possibilities of vote tampering, which we did not see evidence of. Now, there's, you know, what's being discussed in the mainstream media and by different politicians from different camps is that the Obama administration knew about the Russian hack and decided really not to reveal it in full for different sort of political considerations or calculations, and that they're doing so now. Well, why are they doing it now? I mean, what do you think is going on?
Well, my take on it is that they don't have the evidence to show what they're saying. They're just basically reiterating over and over again from different positions, like CIA, the White House, and so on, under the basic assumption that people will believe that what they're saying is true if they say it often enough and from so many different supposedly authoritative sources. My point is really pretty simple. There should be no guessing here at all. They should be able to show the trace routes of all the packets, or some of them anyway, going to the Russians and then from the Russians to WikiLeaks. There's no excuse for not being able to do that. And that would be the basic evidence to prove it. Otherwise, it could be any hacker in the world or any other government in the world. I mean, who knows? You know, the point is they're supposed to prove the assertions that they're making, and they're not doing that. That means, to me, they don't have the evidence, which means to me, again, if this network that NSA has couldn't find the routing of these packets around the network anywhere, then it had to be an insider to do the job. Much like Martin for the TAO access into the source code for their attacks through the networks on different systems, firewalls, and so on. Or much like Edward Snowden, the material he took, or Bradley Manning, the material he took. So those would not go across the network. They would be taken out by a thumb drive or something and then passed separately away from the servers and therefore not be traceable back to those servers.
William Binney, the article that you wrote for VIPS, Vets Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, I want to read to the audience what you wrote because it's essentially the same thing that you're saying here, but I want to read it again because I think it's so important for people to be able, especially people who aren't experts, to wrap their heads around it. You write, "We have gone through the various claims about hacking. For us, it's child's play to dismiss them. The email disclosures in question are the result of a leak, not a hack. Here's the difference between leaking and hacking. Leak, when someone physically takes data out of an organization and gives it to some other person or organization, as Edward Snowden and Chelsea Manning did. Hack, when someone in a remote location electronically penetrates operating systems, firewalls, or other cyber protection systems and then extracts data. All signs point to leaking, not hacking. If hacking were involved, the National Security Agency would know it and know both the sender and the recipient. In short, since leaking requires physically removing data on a thumb drive, for example, the only way such data can be copied and removed with no electronic trace of what has left the server is via physical storage device." I mean, it seems so simple. It seems so basic in the terms of the way you're breaking it down. If they had the evidence of a hack, they would be able to show it. So there is a leak. Who are the leakers? What do you think?
Well, I think I originally suggested some of them could have been from NSA, but it certainly could be from inside the United States government, like, for example, the FBI or even members of CIA or the DEA or the IRS, all of whom, or DHS, for example, all of whom have direct access into the NSA databases, which is where all the storage of all the collected data is, meaning all the emails of Hillary and everybody else in the country. So they could have gone in that way, any of them, and taken them and done that. Or, you know, it could have been somebody in the DNC or, you know, anyone who has access through the system in the government or anybody else who was an insider in any of those organizations could have done it. So it's a matter of finding out who, and you need to go back and look to see. And that, by the way, a lot of that kind of data should be registered in the network logs of the servers involved and also in the network logs of the network if they were passing the data around. All of those kinds of events would be registered in that network log and traceable.
Bill Binney, you were an NSA official for a long time. You were an NSA whistleblower. You paid a heavy price for trying to tell the American people the truth about what was going on in the NSA. The difference between you and, say, 99.9% of all the other people who are talking about this subject on mainstream media or any media is that you actually know what you're talking about. You know what you're talking about because you have the technical expertise to be able to make these assertions. Help the audience just understand what your role was in the NSA, what your specialty is.
Well, I was a senior executive, but on the technical level, we had a two-track approach inside NSA. One was through management, the other was through the technical track. The reason they created that was very simple, is because people who got very good at technical things and solving technical problems, if they moved into management, NSA as a whole would lose that technical skill and capability. So they created the technical track to keep people in the technical track who were good at it, to be able to rise to senior executive level, which is what I did, and that's why I was there. So those were senior level executive positions, not senior management positions. And we were the ones who were looked at to solve the technical problems inside NSA. And so that's basically what I did for fundamentally the world, and also designing programs and systems that would automate analysis and things like that that would help in terms of being able to assist analysis in terms of focusing on problems that were issues to be solved. And that's what I did. In fact, the fundamental underlying software that they're using and system design to look at the world, although they removed certain portions of it that I had done for them, that's fundamentally the work that I left them with when I left. End of October 2001. And I left them with that kind of data, but I had protections built into systems that I built because I was trying to conform to the Constitution and the laws of the country, unlike what they're doing today. So they removed filtering up front. That is, if you had nothing to do with anything in terms of association with the or any indication that you were associated with criminal activity of any kind, then your data wasn't even taken in, and that was filtered out right up front. So the NSA never had your data in any storage device whatsoever. And the second thing, if you were taken in as a part of a zone of suspicion around some criminal activity, then your data was any attribute that could identify you was encrypted until such time as we could show probable cause and get a warrant for you, and then you would be targeted. And then the final one was to audit everything, that is, audit anybody coming into the network and where they went, what they did, how long they stayed, and so on, so that we could monitor with certainty who was doing what on the network and with the data. So FBI, if they came in and tried to take data out that wasn't something that they should be doing, we would be notified of that immediately. And all of that, and for example, if we had that in place, Edward Snowden couldn't have done what he did in terms of downloading all that material, because we would have known immediately that when he started doing it, that was happening. So those are the kinds of things that I did. I was, you know, not only solving different kinds of systems and codes and things like that, but also doing design of operating systems to manage information and help analysis of all kinds.
We're speaking with William Binney. He's the former technical director of the World Geopolitical and Military Analysis at the NSA, a co-founder of SIGINT, Automation Research Center, and now the author of a statement by VIPS. You wrote at the end of your document that was published yesterday, Bill Binney, "As for the comments to the media as to what the CIA believes, the reality is that the CIA is almost totally dependent on NSA for ground truth in the communications arena. Thus, it remains something of a mystery why the media is being fed strange stories about hacking that have no basis in fact." The problem is that once these strange stories are fed to the media and they get repeated over and over and over again, I think 99% of the people start to believe them. And the voices like your voice and the voice of VIPS, well, with the exception of alternative media like here at Radio Sputnik, people are not hearing it. But if they were able to hear it, it would shatter the illusion that's been being created, which I guess is for political purposes.
Yeah, it's this technique of repetition of the assertion from various supposedly authoritative positions. It goes back to the ancient Greece in the school of sophism. It was a standard. It was one of the standard ways they used to try to win arguments, regardless of whether or not you had a reliable or valid syllogism or argument. So it was one way to win over opinion and people without actually having any substance behind what you were saying. And that goes back to ancient Greece.
Right, a tried and true method. We're talking with Bill Binney. We're talking about the assertions made by the CIA that, in fact, the Russian government hacked the emails of the Democratic Party and different centers of Democratic Party power and some Republican Party centers of power, now triggering an allegation by the Obama administration, and it seems like by both parties in Congress, for an inquiry about how Russia's taking over the United States. But Bill Binney and the others in the group Veterans Intelligence Professionals for Sanity said the facts don't add up. This wouldn't need to be circumstantial evidence. If there was a hack, not a leak, the NSA would know about it. But in fact, they can't make that point. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear. And Clear.
You are listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. U.S. Secretary of Defense Ash Carter was in Israel on Monday to deliver the first two F-35 jets, but the Lockheed Martin company's stock fell when Donald Trump took to Twitter to say the costs of the program were out of control. We are joined by Pierre Spray, a lead member of the designer team for the F-16. Welcome back, Pierre.
Oh, good to talk to you.
Pierre Spray, you are a critic, as we know and as our audience knows from your past appearances on Loud and Clear, of the F-35 for numerous reasons. But Donald Trump tweeted on Monday, F-35 program and cost is out of control. Billions of dollars can and will be saved on military and other purchases after January 20th. Lockheed Martin's shares then fell 4.2% or $248.51 in morning trading, a loss of about $2 billion. What do you make of that? Is the F-35 program due to collapse?
I rather doubt it. I mean, I applaud what Trump said. It's, of course, entirely correct, has been true for years. Whether he can deliver on that remains to be seen. I suspect the panic in the stock market is a little premature. The military-industrial complex has enormous power to keep the money flowing. But we will see. I wish Trump all the luck in the world with trying to take some money out of the F-35 program, because it is indeed, not only is it totally out of control in cost, it's a hopelessly ineffective airplane. So there's every reason in the world to try to save the taxpayer some money here.
I hear you on that. One thing that I think our audience is probably wondering about, maybe everyone's wondering about, is why did Donald Trump get involved in the F-35? I mean, there are many, many things that he's been tweeting about. When he tweeted about Air Force One and the fact that the upcoming order might be or should be canceled, it was just minutes after the Boeing CEO, Boeing, of course, is the manufacturer of the Air Force One, his CEO, Dennis Muhlenberg's critical remarks about Trump administration trade policies published in the Chicago Tribune. And then Trump tweeted out, the Air Force One is bad, we should cancel it, blah, blah, blah. I mean, what do you think Trump's motivation is here on the F-35?
I would suspect, very simply, if he has some advisors who actually know something about defense. And the F-35 has been, you know, the leading scandal in the entire defense budget for 10 years. Remember, this is the world's largest military procurement program ever. It completely dwarfs the development of the atomic bomb, you know, the development of intercontinental missiles. Nothing has ever cost this much. So it's not hard to see that it's important. You know, it's like, I don't know of any other spending program in the U.S. as large. So it's kind of visible. If he has, you know, even one person advising him who isn't, you know, committed in one way or another to, you know, to profit from this airplane, it's going to be perfectly obvious that the advisor is going to say, well, you know, you said you wanted to save some money on defense. Here's the single biggest place to save money. It's kind of an obvious target. I don't think he needs a motivation like a CEO of Lockheed or something saying something bad about him.
Yeah. Jeff Babione, Lockheed's F-35 chief, said about the program and Trump's comments, this is an amazing program. It's great value, and I look forward to any questions that the president-elect may have.
The F-35 program, over its entire lifetime, when we buy 2,400 of them, will cost $1.5 trillion. It has not cost that much yet. And that includes operating. It's $1.5 million for buying it and operating it. Just buying it alone is $400 billion, and we haven't spent that yet. Probably have spent something on the order of less than half that so far.
Right. Okay. So the U.S. military only has 168 of the planes in service so far.
Yeah, I think it's taken delivery on more, but that's probably right. Something like 168 are flying. They've probably taken delivery on something like 200, I would guess.
According to the National Priorities Project in 2016, U.S. taxpayers spent $936,703 on F-35 program every hour. Wow. I mean, again, Jeff Babione, Lockheed F-35 chief, said it's a great value. I mean, that's a lot of money.
It's a lot of money for something that not only doesn't work, but every extra one you buy actually harms American air power. For every F-35 you buy, you're foregoing the opportunity to upgrade and refurbish, you know, existing fighters that work far better right now than the F-35 will ever work. So you could upgrade 5 fighters for every F-35 you buy. So obviously, every time you buy one, you're diminishing American air power. The only good thing that's ever come out of the F-35 and the F-22, which is a similarly expensive program, although not as many airplanes, is that we've bamboozled the Russians and the Chinese into trying to copy them. And so they're building grossly expensive, oversized, and unnecessarily sluggish fighters in imitation of what we're doing because we've put out so much propaganda. That's the only benefit I can think of the F-35 and the F-22 programs.
So the Russians and the Chinese are mirroring what you consider to be a huge, colossal waste, and also something that's not effective. It does not have efficacy from a military point of view.
Right. I mean, you know, their airplanes may not be quite as bad because they're not as expensive, but they've certainly ruined a current generation of airplanes that they're working on by imitating what we're doing. There's, of course, the same thing happened in the era of the F-111. We put out equally false propaganda about how wonderful the F-111 was because it had the swing wing technology, and that bamboozled the Russians into putting out three generations of swing wing airplanes, every one of which was a horrible failure.
What makes them a failure? What are your top three, or out of the top 10, what are three of the main defects?
Well, here's one that people won't recognize immediately. The airplane is so complicated that it can only fly extremely rarely. Right now, it's flying once every 5 days. So for 1.5 hours, it flies. The rest of the time, it's in the hangar undergoing maintenance. Why is that so important? First of all, it means no matter how many you buy, you'll never put any useful quantity up over the enemy's territory. You know, if you only fly once every 5 days or even once every 3 days, it's like hopelessly ineffective. No matter what it does, it's not going to show up. But even worse, here's the worst thing about airplanes that you can't fly often enough. You can't train pilots. And pilots, for people who don't know about air combat, are far more important than airplanes. The quality of the pilot always dictates the outcome of the air war. And if you can't train superior pilots to the opposition, you can't win air wars. And if you can't fly at least 30 or 40 hours a month, you'll never have superior pilots. So this airplane makes it impossible to have thoroughly competent, highly skilled pilots. So that's the number one thing that's wrong with it. The complexity and the enormous unreliability makes it impossible to fly often enough. That's really fundamental. Then beyond that, you know, it has completely ruined its aerodynamics and its weight. For two reasons. One, because of the stealth requirement, which is already obsolete because there are all kinds of sensors being built and sold in the world that can see stealth. The Russians are very, very far along that curve and are openly selling radars and infrared gear that can see stealth airplanes. In addition to the problem of stealth with the airplane, which certainly degrades the effectiveness, the airplane was built to a multi-mission specification and a multi-service specification. Nothing could ruin an airplane more than trying to do three different missions in a single airplane. Every multi-mission airplane we've ever designed has been a disaster. Now, you make it even worse when you force the airplane now to serve three different services, because now you're serving three different bureaucracies, and each bureaucracy is putting their own requirements on it. And the inevitable happened with the F-35. The multi-mission requirements made it fat, draggy, terrible fuel consumption, terrible maneuverability. Those were all caused by the fact that you were trying to do air-to-air combat, bombing, and close support all in one airplane. So you got one airplane that can't do any of them. Then you took the same set of requirements and you said, Navy, what do you want out of this? Marines, what do you want out of this? Air Force, what do you want out of this? And they all wanted such different things, each of which, of course, added to the weight and the cost of the airplane, that we are now building three incompatible different airplanes. Yet the whole excuse was, if we build it for three services, we'll save money. The opposite happened. We not only didn't save money, but we helped to ruin the airplane further. So those are the prime things that are wrong with the airplane.
A perfect storm. You have a lot of money to be made by, of course, the manufacturer. You have the military-industrial congressional complex, as Dwight Eisenhower called it in the first draft of his famous farewell speech when he warned about the dangers of the military-industrial complex, so that the F-35 is and all of its subcontractors are spread out all over the country. In other words, all these politicians in Congress have some stake in the maintenance of this project that doesn't work. And at the same time, you have a situation where once you've spent a lot of money, it's hard to stop spending money and declare a program a failure.
Exactly. And that's exactly what Donald Trump is up against. And my prediction is that he will not be able to prevail. That when you're facing a $1.5 trillion juggernaut, even if you're as determined a man as Donald Trump, you're not going to make a very big dent in this program, because they have spread the money to 46 or 48 different states deliberately in order to make sure that somebody like Trump can never cancel this program.
Well, just to help the audience understand what you mean by that, they've spread the money to 46 or 47 or 48 states. How does that work?
They deliberately sought subcontractors in every state where they thought there was a representative or a senator who might have some power of voting for this budget, for this airplane. And that means they picked a whole bunch of inferior subcontractors. They didn't pick subcontractors because they were the best in the world. They didn't pick the guy who makes the nose wheel landing gear because he makes better ones than anybody else in the country. They picked him because he comes from some state that has a powerful senator. You can imagine the quality program you have, the quality problems you have. When you spread money to contractors, to hundreds of contractors across 46 states, you can't control the quality. You've picked contractors that are not the best at what they do. And now you have to control them. You know, when they come back in with an inferior product, you can't fire them because their senator will go nuts. So you've created a horrible, insoluble mess simply for quality control reasons. That's the cost of using defense money basically to suborn the U.S. Congress, and that's what Donald Trump is up against. He's up against a U.S. Congress that is owned by $1.5 trillion spread out across 46 states.
Yeah, and that's a bipartisan affair. And you see, when the military,
yeah, very much so.
When the military budget gets passed, it's usually unanimous or nearly unanimous. There's not a lot of real debate about these kind of things. Trump's comments, again, coincided with Ash Carter's visit to Israel, where he took part and the delivery of the first of what I believe will be 50 F-35s to the Israeli government. Now, Israel signed the deal this year for $38 billion in U.S. military aid. It's ordered 50 of the new fighter jets, each priced around $100 million.
That's a gross underestimate. They will certainly, before it's all finished, they will certainly cost $200 million when all the fixes are in.
Okay, well, that would be double from what the reported amount is, which is $100 million.
Correct. That's the reported amount, and it's a totally phony amount that's never been audited by a single CPA.
That's amazing. Well, Prime Minister Netanyahu said, quote, our long arm has now become longer and mightier as a consequence of the delivery or the beginning of the delivery of the F-35s. But here you have the U.S. Congress and the U.S. government giving Israel about $3 or $4 billion each year in U.S. military aid, and then Israel buys these planes that you say lack efficacy, and many other people say the same thing, and that they're overpriced. In other words, it becomes another form whereby the U.S. taxpayer, vis-a-vis the mechanism of foreign aid to Israel, subsidizes the investors here for a weapon system that's overpriced and doesn't work.
Exactly correct. We are paying for Israeli F-35s, so of course they're going to say nice things about them. If they didn't say nice things about them, we wouldn't send them free airplanes.
Yeah, we're talking with Pierre Spray. He was a lead member of the designer team for the F-16. Pierre, you don't sound very optimistic that no matter what, anything is going to change, because the entrenched, institutionalized, I don't know, is it corruption?
Yeah.
I mean, it sounds like corruption. Maybe it's not called corruption, but when you're doling out money to all of these states to inferior subcontractors, really just to buy the politicians, in essence, to keep a program going, the taxpayers are paying the whole thing.
Exactly. And, you know, if you want to be honest, it is corruption. It's legal. Nobody's going to go to jail, but it's still corruption. It has totally subverted our democratic process and totally subverted our national defense. And that's a tragedy. And I'm sorry to say that I think, you know, Donald Trump is not going to prevail against this juggernaut.
Yeah. It is the power of the military-industrial complex. The old saying goes, the old one that says, you know, politicians come and go, but the police remain. I think it could be updated here. The politicians come and go, but the military-industrial congressional complex, it remains. And it really does seem to be, Pierre Spray, the dominant power in America. We have about a minute left. If you were talking to, like, okay, you were on national TV and you had your, you know, 1 minute to tell the American people what should be done, what would you tell them?
Well, let's be practical. You can't cancel this. It certainly deserves to be canceled, but you can at least keep it from being expanded. They're trying to expand this program every year and get us more and more committed. We should hold the production right where it is and use some of the savings to at least try to fix these airplanes that are failing right in less than testing. Right now, there's not even enough money in the budget to fix them. We just keep on producing new airplanes that are a failure when they come off the production line. So in all conscience, what you really want to do is hold the production where it is. That's possible, maybe possible politically, and then use some of the savings to give back to the taxpayer and the rest to fix this airplane that is in horrible, horrible trouble.
Yes, and Pierre Spray, one last little tidbit, little piece of information. Maybe it's a trivia fact, but all current student loan debt, and student loans became a big deal during the 2016 presidential primaries, at least, it represents a staggering $1.3 trillion. Of course, what the estimates are, as you said, if the F-35 goes through its entire production cycle, it will be, in fact, more than $1.3 trillion. So it's not like there's not money someplace. It's just the money is going one place instead of some other place. We are talking to Pierre Spray. He was a lead member of the designer team for the F-16. That's all the time we have. We'll be back tomorrow. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We are out of here.
Loud and Clear.